What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by Sports Illustrated staff writer and all-around great guy, wonderful person, Rohan Netkarni. Rohan, how are you doing? How was your Memorial Day weekend?
It was good. You know, like many Memorial Day weekends of the past, it was filled with basketball. So, you know, I guess it wasn't that different than the normal weekend this time of year. But, you know, the games were fine. I'm not even going to go ahead and say the games were great. The games were fine. But, you know, I can't complain, Michael. How about you?
My Memorial Day weekend was wonderful. I golfed a little bit, which I haven't done in a very, very long time, so that was very peaceful and wonderful, even though I played terribly. And I'm still down in Florida, your neck of the woods, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Miami Heat, who were eliminated from the NBA playoffs, swept by the Milwaukee Bucks a little bit later. But I want to start
how terribly exactly you are at golf. What are we talking here? What did you shoot? What was the situation? You know, could you give us a little bit more detail? Felt like you just kind of glossed over that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. I'm here for this. You know, I don't want to, you know, pat myself on the back. I did play in high school and I think I was okay. I wasn't a young Tiger Woods or anything like that. But you know, I can putt a little bit.
Okay.
I can chip.
Okay.
I got a pretty good
drive. Oh, you can chip.
I can chip, baby.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. And I hit it pretty far. Not so much straight yesterday. And my wife was actually like living on the middle of the fairway, and I was all over the place. So that was fun. I do not like losing to her. Can we talk basketball now? Is that okay?
Sure, sure. No, that was a pretty good. That was a pretty good recap. Thank you.
Okay, so you know we're gonna get to a bunch of awesome emails from our listeners, but I want to start with a bit of a bummer of a topic that hopefully won't define the playoffs as much as it did the regular season, even if it's starting to feel that way. And of course, I'm talking about injuries. Injuries are bad. Last night, Joel Embiid left game four against the Wizards after falling on his tailbone. He was listed as out with right knee soreness, and I believe is getting an MRI today. We will not know the result of that. We do not know the result of that MRI right now as we record, but hopefully he gets back on the court as soon as possible. Anthony Davis left game four against the Suns with a strained groin and is questionable for game five of that series. Luka Doncic was clearly hampered by a neck strain in game four against the Clippers, and as a result, his Mavs were completely blown out of the water. I could just like go on and on here. Chris Paul hurt his shoulder 2 seconds into game one against the Lakers. You know, then we have like some role players like Dante DiVincenzo, who was ruled out for the rest of the playoffs. Jeff Green might miss the entire second round showdown against the Bucks, or anticipated showdown against the Bucks, which is pretty important, I think, for Brooklyn. You know, Serge Ibaka's been out for the past like 3 months, but he kind of popped his head into action in the first two games of the series before being ruled out in games three and four. We obviously don't have Jamal Murray. We don't have Jaylen Brown. We did not have your boy Victor Oladipo. So I just want to, you know, throw it to you, Rohan. Like, how concerning are all these injuries? Just like as a viewer of the game and someone who wants to see the best players compete this time of year, especially, you know, coming out of a regular season that was just so marred by injuries to so many key players. Like, I thought that we might have potentially been beyond it, and I guess we aren't, and that's a bummer.
I think it's deeply concerning, and I think that there's a lot of talk about, was the bubble real, right? Or maybe not a lot of talk, but you hear it every now and then. Oh, what was real from the bubble? What was a fluke, et cetera, et cetera. I think this season's been just as different, even though teams are traveling. And how do you make any conclusions from this season? You had teams coming in with 2 months off, your team's coming in with 9 months off. I mean, you can speak to this. I mean, at any point did you feel like the Celtics season got going, right? It always felt like there was something popping up. It was a new player in the protocol, et cetera, et cetera. I was talking to, you know, we did our playoff preview package for Sports Illustrated. I spoke to Michelle Roberts, and I asked her because the league, you know, they said numbers-wise, injuries aren't up. Like, you know, they presented this data, and they said, you know, the number of players on injury reports, et cetera, injuries aren't up. And I think Michelle Roberts was like, you know, I can't argue with the numbers, but anecdotally, like what I hear from the players, it's just obviously this season's been a lot different, and they say they can feel it in their bodies. And I think it's a little bit too neat to immediately draw a line from this regular season to all the players missing time. Like, who really knows? I don't think injury science is an exact one, but it's hard to ignore that, right? It's hard to ignore how weird this regular season was, how compressed it was, the number of issues we had during it, and somehow not expect it to trickle over into the playoffs. It is a shame because, you know, that first weekend of games was so good, and it really felt like we were headed back toward a quote-unquote pretty normal playoff. I mean, fans are back in the stands, et cetera, although that's been its own disaster. Yeah. And it just, yeah, man, you said it. There's not really much you can say other than it sucks, and you just want to see all these teams compete at full strength. It is concerning because I think it is not necessarily being discussed enough just how weird this season is, because it's not the bubble. You know, it's been given a little bit of a break almost, but I think that this season is like equally weird and equally difficult to draw conclusions from as last one was.
Yeah, you know, obviously this was a 72 game season. Obviously there was not an ideal amount of time to rest and recuperate and practice and get treatment and all of that this year. I thought that was you can't overlook it. And you know, when I'm watching these games, I think there are some injuries that are just bad luck, I think, like Joel Embiid falling over. And, you know, Joel Embiid has injury history. His body is very unique. It's humongous, and he's explosive. And, you know, he's had a lot of he's had several lower body surgeries. And so, you know, he falls over on his tailbone pretty hard, gets up. His knee seems to have been impacted. And I just think that could have happened no matter what. But then I also look at someone like Anthony Davis, whose team, you know, won the championship last year, had the shortest or tied for the shortest turnaround with the Miami Heat. And like, he just never looked right this entire mm-hmm. season. Like, I thought he was going to be an MVP candidate. I thought coming out of the bubble, he was maybe the best player in the world. I said that multiple times.
He looked as good as he'd had at any point in his career during the bubble. Yep. And then it never clicked.
Yeah, totally unstoppable. We have not seen that Anthony Davis really for any consistent stretches this entire season. And he goes down with, I mean, he was suffering from a previous injury before he strained his groin trying to drive baseline in game four near the end of the second quarter. And like, I don't know, I kind of do attribute that to everything that's happened the past 2 years. I can't help myself. And I truly believe, and this take gets people very upset for some reason, I don't know why, but like, I truly believe that when we look back at the past two seasons, this season and the bubble season, like, there just will be an asterisk beside them. And I don't want to get into the asterisk conversation, but I've talked about this countless times. Like, I don't think an asterisk needs to be seen as a negative point of contention. It just reflects an obvious difference between every other season in NBA history and what we've seen going through a pandemic and playing basketball during this very, very strange time in all of our lives. And so I don't want people to get upset. I'm not saying that the Lakers didn't deserve to win
it's
a title
also
or
like
shouldn't be commended. It's just, yeah.
Sometimes an asterisk means it could be harder. You know, we're not even saying that this asterisk means, you know, this path was easier or this path was,
yep.
It just means different. It just is. I mean, I don't know if I would go so far to say asterisk, by the way, so direct all your complaints towards Michael. I'm trying to offer a defense of my friend here more than anything, but I am on your side, all you anti-asterisk people. But I think the point you're making, and it's a good one, is these 2 years have been very different. And I would caution anyone to make any kind of hard and fast conclusions about their teams based on these 2 years, because of, like you're saying, they're just so different and they represent a very strange period in NBA history.
And we should also like acknowledge that injuries are part of the game. Injuries impact just about every postseason in NBA history. And, you know, you go back to 2018, just popping into the top of my head, like Chris Paul straining his hamstring, and the Houston Rockets probably would have won the title that year. And we would look at a lot of different players differently, like Harden and CP and Mike D'Antoni, if he didn't suffer that injury. And then, you know,
2019, Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson.
Yes, it is. You can go on and on and on and on and on. Exactly. And
I just want to say it is weird sometimes when you look back, I don't know. It's weird because you're right. Like every year during the playoffs, there are injuries and you're like, I can't believe this is happening. But when you look back, you almost like, oh, yeah, there was a huge injury that year. But anyway, continue.
No. Yeah. And it's just, it stinks because like I want to watch Chris Paul is, you know, close to 100% or whatever, or just like looking like Chris Paul, the Phoenix Suns are way more enjoyable to watch. And that series is way more intriguing. And you actually feel like Phoenix has a chance to pull off this. I don't want to say it's a monumental upset, but I don't know. LeBron James losing in the first round, I'm sorry, like Phoenix fans, I don't mean to draw your ire, but that would be pretty surprising. That guy does not usually lose early in the playoffs slash ever. So that would be surprising, and it would be a really cool story for a lot of different reasons. And maybe they still are able to pull this out because AD can't go, or Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is hampered, or whatever. But like, I just want to see everybody healthy. I just want to see the best of the best compete at a high level. That's what the playoffs are all about. And it stinks. Like Luka, even just Luka, who he just looks like he's in pain playing basketball. It's like, I don't want to watch that. I want to watch the same guy who was like lighting it up in the first two games, hitting these miraculous shots, being a magician. Like that's what NBA playoff basketball is all about. And I wish we could get back to that. Hopefully we still can. I don't know.
I hope so, too, and I hope that the NBA is looking at this, and I understand that, you know, they seem to have planned out next season, et cetera, but whether it's building in more rest for the next couple of years to kind of account for what happened this year, I think years from now we're going to realize, even though they obviously had the financial incentive to return from this for themselves, I think years from now is when we'll finally start to appreciate what this current group of players did for the long-term health of the NBA, because it wasn't just about making up all this money this season. It was getting the league back on track for the next 4 or 5 years. And in many ways, I think it's actually a pretty big sacrifice that the group of players made this season, because mm-hmm. just seeing what is happening to them and hearing from them about the mental and physical toll of this season, it's been massive for sure.
No, that's a great point by you. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit, Rohan, and talk about your Miami Heat. They were swept over the weekend.
Why are you turning this podcast into one whole troll job about me being a fan of the Miami Heat? Like,
no,
everyone knows you're a Celtics fan, right? Like, I feel like I'm being put on Miami Heat Island every episode.
No. This is okay. Just a facts-only podcast, see, and you're a Miami Heat fan, okay. So I got to bring it up every time. It's okay.
Keeping it 100, as the exactly. kids would say. Keeping yes, it 100%. Exactly. Okay.
I know you can take it. Okay. So the Miami Heat were swept. I have a question for you. Obviously, Miami went to the finals last year, and a lot of their issues throughout the regular season, you know, they were hampered by COVID, health and safety protocols, injuries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where do they go from here, man? Like, Do you think that they can get back to the finals with Jimmy Butler on the roster? There's so many questions, and this offseason is particularly interesting to me just because of, you know, you got Duncan Robinson's restricted free agency, you got Victor Oladipo's bird rights, what are you going to do there? You got some cap space, are you going to be able to spend it on a third star? I think it's really, really fascinating how they sustain their success. And obviously there are expectations now for them to get back to the mountaintop. So like, can they, like, what is the path there, Rohan?
It's really interesting. The question, can they make the finals with Jimmy Butler on the roster? I think is a yes. I think the more kind of pressing question is, can they make the finals with Jimmy and Bam as their two best guys? Mm. And that's where I think it gets really interesting, because Bam, I think, as good as he's been, as fun as he's been, you saw this series, you know, against the Bucks, where they basically dared him to be an aggressive offensive player. And sometimes he was, but most of the times he was not. Most of the time he was not, I should say. And the Heat's offense suffered. And that's an improvement that he needs to go through. That's a playoff failure that he's experienced that, you know, he needs to grow from. And I'm confident that he will, but he's obviously just a much younger player than Jimmy. And that's always been a little awkward part of their construction, is the different timelines those guys are on. So I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't try to take some swings this offseason. I'm sure they're going to try to go after Kyle Lowry. I don't really think Kawhi is in play after the last couple of games of this Clippers-Mavs series, which is crazy to say, but I do think that's how this stuff works sometimes. I think the Bucks exposed them a little bit, and I know that, you know, Heat fans are like very sensitive about people calling them bubble flukes, etc. I think you and I are on the same page that it's not a fluke, but it is like a once in a lifetime event. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, it's funny when you see, like, you know, the Bucks account tweet, like, this isn't the bubble. And it was like, well, then what happened to your team in the bubble? You know what I mean? I don't think people need to like worry about their title run, et cetera. But I do think that the Bucks exposed, which is guys like Kendrick Nunn, Tyler Hero, they can be targeted in a playoff series, and the Heat were just somehow able to do a better job of hiding them last year. Those guys were playing better offensively last year. The same could be said for Goran Dragic, who was playing like at an all-star level during the playoffs in the bubble. And this year, you know, he just had a bunch of injuries. I don't think his body ever got right during the regular season, and he just wasn't as effective. And I don't think you can go into a playoff series with those many guys who can be attacked and aren't two-way guys. And like Jimmy and Bam were their only really reliable two-way guys for the whole series, and I think that created a massive problem. I think Jay Crowder, they missed him, as crazy as it sounds, even though his hot shooting was a big reason of what made him useful. I still think in many ways he was a more well-rounded player than Trevor Ariza is at this stage, so I do think they need a little bit of an overhaul around Jimmy and Bam. It's funny, like, they didn't even need the best Pacers version of Victor Oladipo, but just the fact that he's someone who could create his own shot, you know, in a pick and roll, and then also stop dribble penetration on the other end, he would have been really helpful in that series. So this is a long way of me saying I think they need a pretty serious overhaul. I think they'll try to keep Duncan Robinson for sure, just because I think his shooting is that important to their offense. But I kind of think they need to figure out what is the best way to build around Jimmy and Bam, because obviously they did not have great series in the first round. I don't want to let them off the hook, but I also think they're being asked to do so much because they're constantly covering up for deficiencies elsewhere in the roster.
Yeah, I think first of all, Bucks Twitter should probably settle down. Like, Jrue Holiday is +98 in that series. Jrue Holiday was not on the Milwaukee Bucks last year. Like, big difference.
He was incredible, by the way. He was incredible.
Yeah, like I said, +98. Nobody else was even +90. Nobody else was even +80 so far in the playoffs. Like, he's just plus minuses, whatever it is. But Jrue Holiday is unbelievable. I will say, I did not expect, like, I expected this to be a competitive series. Mm-hmm. I know you were spot on with your prediction of Bucks in five, and I didn't expect Jimmy Butler to score 8 more points than Jason Tatum did in a single game in the entire series. That was not something that was on my radar. As you said, I did not expect Bam Adebayo to look so passive offensively. Like, I was anticipating the guy, you know, sometimes when I think about Bam, I think about that game against the Nets earlier this year that was in Miami when he hit the buzzer beater. And he's just like isolating on whoever and getting buckets and getting to the free throw line and hitting jump shots. And I thought that that guy was going to be who existed in this series. And it never was, unfortunately. You know, Miami's offense in that series, their offensive rating was 95.4. The Knicks, that's the worst in the playoffs. The Knicks are the second worst at 103.1. Like, anyone who's watched the Knicks play basketball over the past week and a half, like, that is really, really disturbing. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, it is. Are you kidding me?
No. It was. And listen, Spo deserves some criticism as well. You know, I'm a big Eric Spoelstra fan. You know, it was a failure. I do think that. One thing I'll just add, and we already obviously have had the discussion about this is a weird season, you know, and the reason I picked the Bucks, and honestly, like, I gave them five just because I was like, I think Jimmy will win one, is, like, they're a way better team. They're a way more consistent team. This is not to let the Heat off the hook, like, they have serious issues. I do also think sometimes you just get beat, and I think that, like, sometimes you just run into not only a better team, but a more motivated team, a more focused team. And, like, that was it. I think that mentally, like, the air just went out of the balloon for the Heat. I'm sure they were also mentally and physically tired from this season, like a lot of teams were. People were like, oh, they folded. And I'm like, I don't think that's it. I just think that sometimes you get beat. But anyway, I don't want to stop you from making your point. So keep going.
No, I mean, to what you just said real quick, I thought that game three at home, that was the worst loss. That was the worst Heat loss that I can honestly remember, like, in recent history. It's certainly the worst loss of the Jimmy Butler era. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I want to give all credit in the world to the Bucks, who, you know, I think that they were super focused because of what happened in the bubble. Like, I think that these two things are connected. Absolutely.
Right.
And that series against the Heat completely altered how they play basketball on defense and forced them to look in the mirror. So it did them good in a lot of ways. But yeah, like, you know, going forward for Miami real quick, you know, they have some cap space here. You mentioned Kyle Lowry. I think Spencer Dinwiddie is an interesting player who could pop up here in conversations in a little bit. People are sleeping on him. He's extremely good and could be affordable. You know, Lonzo Ball, I don't know how much of a fan you are of Lonzo Ball, but
I'm a huge fan of Lonzo, and what I'd never understand is why he's always so available. I think he would be great on a number of teams.
Yeah, so
he shot the hell out of the ball this year too.
Sure, yeah, no, he's intriguing. I think he could get overpaid a little bit this summer because he's restricted, and teams do want him in a very barren free agent class. So he could get a lot of money, and, you know, that could, if you're also going to re-sign Duncan Robinson, who's going to draw a lot of interest and possibly more than I think he. You know, I don't want to say deserves, but, like, the way he was attacked defensively by Chris Middleton is pretty concerning to me if I'm paying someone $80 million or $90 million or whatever he's going to get.
I don't want to turn this into a Heat podcast, but can we have the Duncan conversation very quickly?
Sure.
I went from, you got to pay to keep this guy, he's so important to the offense, to maybe it's a bad sign how important he is to the offense, and you let him go because this. I do think the bidding is going to get out of hand in a way, not so much that I care about Mickey Arison's money as much as obviously this is a salary capped league, and you have to figure out how to best allocate your resources. What do you think the Heat should do with him?
I don't know. I think that it wouldn't shock me if there was a sign and trade situation. And I don't know. I haven't gone deep into the woods to see who would. I mean, I think a lot of teams would be interested in him. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there's teams over the cap who would love to have Duncan Robinson, who cannot pay him the money that he's going to garner. But if you're Miami, heading into the tax with Duncan, and then you got to you're just really banking on a lot of different things. You're banking on Jimmy not declining. You're banking on Tyler Hero improving dramatically from a very disappointing sophomore season. You're banking on Bam developing another superpower and, potentially adding a 3-point shot to his game, stuff like that. I don't know, because I think that the East is just, the Bucks aren't going anywhere. The Nets certainly aren't going anywhere. And so you got to look at your payroll, and if championship is what you want, a championship is what you think you can get, then, I don't know. The payroll could just be astronomical, is I guess the point. And we haven't even really talked too much about Victor Oladipo. So I think losing a restricted free agent for nothing is usually catastrophic. Just look at Bogdan Bogdanovic as the most recent example. But paying him, if it goes up to 90, and there was talk before, when Davis Bertans signed his deal, and Joe Harris signed his deal, about $100 million contract. I have all the respect for outside shooting, and he's one of the best to ever do it, literally. But we also
just saw it neutralized to a degree in a mm-hmm. playoff round. And I wonder how that will affect his market if it does. But I think I'm with you. I think that they have to have a number in mind and stand firm on it. And I hate being that guy, because I want all players in this league to make as much money as they want. And, yeah, I just think it's going to be fascinating, because I do think that, him, Hero, Nunn, they all got really exposed during this series, and I'm very fascinated. The Heat have always had this problem with, you need shooting around Jimmy, but you can't really play Hero and Robinson together. That lineup was good during the regular season. I don't think that a Hero Robinson lineup could ever survive in a postseason round.
I hear that, and I think the bubble kind of warps how we view what happened with that team and that core. But sometimes I look at players like Duncan Robinson, and I'm like, your destiny in the NBA might be taking a pretty good team and just making them way more potent, but not quite where the stakes are championship or bust. So putting Duncan Robinson, for example, on the New York Knicks, if the Knicks have a ton of cap space, if I was the Knicks, I'd just be like, wow, if we added Duncan Robinson, that would just make everyone else's life so much easier. We have no outside shooting. Let's add this guy who zooms around, stagger screens, and just totally manipulates defensive coverages because of his gravity. That's a player and a situation that I think makes more sense maybe than Duncan in Miami, even though I think the fit in Miami is really good.
I'm
with you. I don't want to turn this into a Heat podcast, especially because there's a lot of teams that are still playing basketball. So maybe we should shift towards one of them. The Brooklyn Nets, we just talked about, they're still going to be out there in the Eastern Conference for the foreseeable future. I'm watching them just completely mutilate my Boston Celtics.
Hey, Boston's putting up a great fight. Those games have been more interesting than they've had any right to be, even the ones that were blowouts at the end. And that game three, man, I mean, that's a fight they didn't have to show. No Jaylen, going up against his juggernaut. I've been impressed with them in a lot of ways. Even Tristan Thompson's had some moments where he's getting me fired up. He gets, he's drawn a big foul going up for the, I just want to say there's a special place in my heart for big men who are battling on the board so hard that they draw a foul going for an offensive rebound. Obviously Tristan's not had a great year. I don't think he's a fan favorite, but all I'm saying is I'm impressed with the fight the Celtics have shown this series, considering how undermanned they've been.
Every time Tristan Thompson grabs an offensive rebound, an angel is born. And every time Tristan Thompson tries to go back up with that offensive rebound, an angel loses its wings. It's basically the Tristan Thompson experience. But like my question about Brooklyn, do you think that they're like even better than you thought they'd be? Like,
yes.
You look at some of these. Okay, well, podcast over. No, but like, you look at some of these numbers, man, and they're just not really making any sense. Like, the offensive rating of their starting lineup in four games is 137.4. You take Bruce Brown and you sub him in for Blake Griffin with Kyrie, Harden, KD, Joe Harris. The offensive rating is 140 in, I think, like 20 minutes, which isn't a ton, but it's just, I don't care if it's 20 minutes. That's,
I mean, you can see it. You can see it while they're playing. This is unstoppable.
Like, truly unstoppable stuff. Like, this is, in my opinion, I hope this isn't a hot take, but, like, I think that this is the best offense that has ever existed. I think it's better than the 2017-2018 Warriors. I think that, and it's really funny to compare those two because KD right. exists, but KD right now is... I mean, he was unstoppable, of course, on the Warriors. But right now, he's like isolating even more. I mean, he leads all players in the postseason in points. Just, like, right, he's like 55, 40, 90. Like, just, I keep using the word unstoppable. I don't know what else to say about him. I don't know what else to say about Harden just isolating at will. The step back is back. He's knocking that down like nobody's business. Like, I see these guys and, you know, they're all ridiculous shot creators and shot makers, Kyrie included. And whenever they isolate, they are surrounded by literally some of the greatest shooters that have ever picked up a basketball, like three of them at all times. Like, I don't want to just say that we should just give them the crown right now for the title, but I just, who is keeping their offensive rating below a historic level for an entire series? I don't know. I think that the Bucks series is going to be amazing, and whoever wins that series, I think, will be in the driver's seat to win the NBA championship. But just like, elaborate a little bit more on what you've seen from them so far, Rohan, and if you kind of agree with me or if I'm being a little too hyperbolic.
Well, I do think part of it is Boston is uniquely challenged to defend them right now, based on the fact that how much they were, you know, playing Thompson, Robert Williams before he got hurt. I do think the Celtics, you know, what's really funny is like for 2 years, the Celtics probably had a pretty good lineup to defend these guys when they had Gordon Hayward. And it was like, do we play like Jaylen Brown at center? Can we get away with that? And I was like, no, not really. But this year probably would have been the year for it.
Instead, we have Evan Fournier getting exactly. hunted down on every possession.
Right. So I do think that next series is going to look really different for Brooklyn just because Milwaukee can go small and put five really good guys on the court in a way that, you know, I think if Jaylen Brown was playing this series, it would have been a little bit more interesting. I don't know that I would have picked the Celtics or anything, but I think it genuinely could have been a lot closer. I do think the Nets are better in that. I don't know. I'm still amazed at how quickly those three guys have come together and played as well as they have. Obviously, they were very talented. I thought they would be good. But the fact that they've barely played together and now are just doing this during the playoffs is crazy. Like you mentioned, like every time, you know, one of them has the ball and they're isolating and I'm like, you know, for a minute, I'm like, oh yeah, this is a good idea. You have to guard them one-on-one. Don't let the other guys get open. That's stupid. And then it's like, then I'm like, what am I thinking? It's James Harden against Tristan Thompson. And then I'm like, okay, obviously you send a second guy. Like, don't, like, what are you doing? You can't let them isolate. And then I'm like, why is Kyrie Irving open on the wing right now? Like, why is his defender taking six steps away from him? I'm just like, yeah, this is a conundrum. I don't know you know, sometimes I catch myself thinking, like, how would, like, the 98 Bulls, like, try to defend this team? Or, like, how would this great defensive team from the past, like, try to stop them? And every time I think of a team, I'm like, yeah, they would have to play a style completely different from what they really played. Like, maybe the 2017 Rockets, who spent their, like, entire year getting ready to, like, switch everything against Golden State, maybe that team would have been good at defending this team. But the fact that they've spent so little time on the court together, but just are leveraging their talent so well offensively, it's incredible. I do think that they have not run into it. Milwaukee, I think, is the only team with the personnel to theoretically slow them down. And the only other teams maybe are the Clippers and a healthy Lakers team. But I thought Philly had a chance. I don't see how Philly defends this team at all, even with the healthy Embiid. Like, him having to cover that much ground in 40 minutes a night, I don't think is a recipe for success. It's going to come down to Milwaukee. Like, they can't play Brooke Lopez. Brooke Lopez was a huge reason for their success against Miami. Like, he can't be hanging out in the paint against this Nets team. I don't know if you want to get into Nets Bucks talk right away, but I just think that they've been so good, and I think that Giannis at center is the only thing I can conceive of in my mind that would maybe slow them down a little bit.
It's like, if you're, and yeah, we can preview that series, you know, just before the Celtics are officially eliminated, I'm fine with it, whatever. If worst case scenario, it's a great reverse jinx for me, or best case scenario. I'm really interested to see the lineups that, because, like, that's why you get PJ Tucker. You get PJ Tucker to play Giannis at the five and switch everything if you want to compete with the Nets, I think. And you spoke to PJ Tucker earlier this season about that exact scenario. I mean, he's not really playing, or he didn't really play a ton of minutes, and they didn't really have to go small against the Heat because they would just drop Brooke into the paint and they would live with a lot of those threes that just were clanging off the rim against Miami. But I'm fascinated to see if Bud will even start game one with Brooke Lopez hanging around in the paint.
He will start game one with Brooke Lopez hanging around in the paint. That I'm confident of.
Yeah, so that'll just be...
Hopefully it's like one of those, like, subs after 2 minutes. He calls timeout when it's like 11 zip. And but that's how I'm envisioning the series starting.
I think about how the Spurs guarded Harden when he was on the Rockets, and they would put, like, Tiago Splitter at the rim, and they would just, like, shepherd Harden into the paint and force him to take tough floaters. But, like, you can't do that now because Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant are also going to be on the court, and they're going to be, like, running a flare screen, and there's going to be chaos on the weak side, and Joe Harris, who, by the way, led the entire NBA in three-point shooting, is also on the floor doing stuff. So it's just a completely different animal, and I cannot wait for that series. I think that you make a good point about bringing the Clippers up. I think the Clippers will, because they can score at such a high rate, and I think they have the second best offense in the postseason right now, and they had, I think, the second best offense during the regular season, and Kawhi Leonard is just on a different planet right now. I think to beat the Nets, you need to just attack them, because defense is obviously their weakness still, and as we saw in game three, like, Jason Tatum was just isolating like a madman and getting whatever he wanted, and he finished with 50. Kawhi, Paul George, whoever else can step up offensively for the Clippers, I think that that is a really interesting matchup, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves right now. So
no, but they've looked that good that they are one of those teams that you're like, who can slow them down and what would it take? Like, they've become that kind of team. I almost think that, you know, I brought up the 2017 Rockets. Like, it's no secret. Like, they've talked about this since, like, their one goal that entire year was to beat Golden State, right? Because they knew that was the de facto championship, was beating Golden State. And if Chris Rock, Paul, Chris Rock, if Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, I think you're right. They win that series in probably six in Houston and win the finals that year. I think that it's probably too late, but I think teams in the league right now need to have an eye toward Brooklyn because all the other contenders are conventional enough in that they're not going to take this highly specific style of basketball to beat. But if you want to beat the Nets, I think that they're the kind of team that you need to make sure that you have a plan or a lineup in mind for because they cannot be beat conventionally.
100%. I agree with you. Okay, so let's transition to a series that's actually going on right now that may end by most of the time our listeners actually hear this episode. But we have an email from our good friend, listener Harry Calloway, who writes, "Hi. Looking at the Hawks, they have a very impressive offense. Their pick and roll with Trae Young's passing and floater, Capella's lob threat, and three other shooters, including John Collins, has amazing potential. Do you think that they'll finish off the Knicks? And how would they match up against the 76ers or possibly the Wizards if you think they have a realistic shot at getting past the first round? Interested in a response." So, Harry, first of all, thank you so much for the email. And I love the way that you hedge there at the end by saying the Wizards have a chance, which, you know, if Joel Embiid is out for the rest of the series, who the hell knows? But, Rohan, let's focus on, I mean, first, I don't know if you agree with me, but I think that, yes, the Hawks will eventually, either in their next game or the game after, finish off the Knicks.
Yes, this should have been a
totally
sweep.
Overmatched. Yes,
if Nate McMillan had simply played as starters in game two, I think this is a sweep. But yes, continue.
I agree. So let's, you know, I actually just like previewed this question by saying we were going to stick to the present, but we're not. Sorry, I lied. Let's look forward to the what feels like an inevitable second round matchup real quick against the between the Hawks and the 76ers. Do you think that, you know, we'll assume that Embiid is able to play if he's hampered a little bit, whatever, but do you think that the Hawks actually have a chance in that series? And if so, why?
Well, it's funny because you immediately want to talk yourself into, well, how is Embiid going to handle Trae Young in pick and rolls? Because I don't think Embiid wants to, again, play, you know, at level or edge or anything like that for 40 minutes a night. I do think he has the athleticism, you know, late in the fourth quarter, late in shot clocks, maybe sometimes coming up on those pick and rolls a little bit, but it's not something he's going to be doing regularly. I mean, you can put Simmons on him, and I think Simmons can do a great job. Simmons can fight over screens, etc., you know, make life easier for Embiid in that regard. So you can kind of start talking yourself into Atlanta being successful offensively in that series. I do think, and this happens sometimes in the playoffs, Atlanta's been great. I mean, they've been great for a long time now, ever since Nate McMillan took over. When they've been healthy, they have a really, really good starting five. Like, they just have some really good players there. They're like the opposite of Miami in that their star can shoot, and they put a bunch of 3-and-D guys, you know, 3-and-D-ish guys around him, and it's working. I do think an issue with Atlanta is they're not being challenged at all defensively right now by the Knicks. Like, the Knicks are easy to defend, I think, for this Atlanta team. And I think that that has a huge trickle effect, like, on a series. Like, you're just not spending as much, like, physical or mental energy on that end of the floor. And I think that would be completely different in a series against Philly, where Embiid, I mean, Capella, you know, Capella's defensive brilliance against the Knicks, for example, is almost entirely predicated on him being mobile and hanging out in the paint and basically stopping Julius Randle from going in there. It's asking him to do something entirely different to guard Joel Embiid one-on-one in the post. I just think that it's going to be an entirely different challenge for Atlanta. I wouldn't pick them to win the series. I'd give them a small chance. I don't think it would be impossible for them to upset the Sixers, but it just is a completely different challenge than what they're seeing against the Knicks right now.
Yeah, I wrote last week about, or over the weekend, about how the Knicks were not attacking Trae Young on defense. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is just an absolute, like, critical part of, or critical ingredient for the recipe to defeat Atlanta in a playoff series. Like, that is just low hanging fruit. You got to take advantage. And Reggie Bullock is just not, I mean, they're just hiding Trey on Reggie Bullock. And Reggie Bullock, look, a slight segue, but like, when Reggie Bullock is like your third best player or your third most consistent player, you're just not a very good team. And so I'm sorry to the Knicks fans who had their hopes up for this series, but they just, that just, it just never was going to happen. But like, you know, defensively for Randle, I mean, you make a really good point about how they're guarding the Knicks. And it's just like whoever's on Julius Randle shades him to his right hand, and then there's help. Either Capella or Collins or whoever's on the back line, and then Randle settles for some really difficult fadeaway that does not go in. And that is so many of their offensive possessions, instead of trying to isolate Randle or isolate Barrett onto Trae Young, which I think they need to have more more force doing and more of a commitment with, but it's probably slash definitely too late for them to do that. So when I look ahead to the Sixers series, I think that that is exactly, maybe not the key to beating Atlanta, because, you know, if Joel Embiid is healthy, I don't know what the answer is there. And then you have your own set of problems, but like, you got to attack Trae Young. And I think defensively, Philly will probably start with Danny Green on him, because that's what they did during the regular season. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know how much we can necessarily take away from that, though. And you bring up Ben Simmons, who missed one of the three games against Atlanta and barely played in one of their games, which was a 44-point blowout. So if you're, you know, thinking that the Sixers are going to dominate, that game will probably support your case. But like, putting Ben Simmons on Trey, I feel like, is not the answer. Like, you could get him...
I don't think it's something that they would do full time or anything like that. I do think it's a more of like an ace in the hole kind of scenario.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I remember, you know, like when Heat LeBron would guard Tony Parker.
Right, or Derrick Rose or et cetera. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're on the same page there, but like, if Trey just hides out on the other end on Danny Green, and Danny Green can't really get involved in the offense, and you just kind of let him relax in the corner, I think that that's a problem. And I'm sure Doc Rivers will have something ready for that, and prevent that from happening. But on the other end, like, outside of Trae Young and his role in the series, like, I'm really interested to see who guards Ben Simmons. Like, are they going to throw DeAndre Hunter on him, or do you put Hunter on Tobias Harris? And I don't know if DeAndre Hunter can eliminate Tobias Harris, but if you just kind of make Tobias's life really difficult, I think that that offense low key is impacted severely. And then you put John Collins on Simmons, and you let Simmons, or you let John Collins sort of help out on post ups off Simmons and throw a lot of size on Embiid. I think that that might be what we see, but again, we're probably potentially getting a little ahead of ourselves, especially because Brad Beal and Russell Westbrook are going to lead the Washington Wizards to a miraculous comeback in this series.
I'll also just throw this out about Philly. I think you and I probably both have not even an eyebrow raised, but an eyebrow, you know, there's like a current going through it. What is their offense going to look like when they get pressured in a playoff series? I think we still probably have some questions. So is Atlanta the team to do it, to put the right pressure on them? I'm not sure, but you know, they're another team that obviously they've been great in the first round. They're the number one seed, etc. They're really, really good. I just want to see someone apply a little pressure to them in a playoff series on their offense in the fourth quarter and see how they respond.
Yeah, it's tough not knowing Embiid's health, which we referred to at the top. But if he is either not 100% for the series or on a minutes restriction or even misses a game or two, like, I would not be stunned if the Hawks beat the Philadelphia 76ers in advance to the conference finals, which is just like a totally ridiculous thing to say out loud. But like, Atlanta could do it. Atlanta is really good. They're so deep. They have a lot of three-point shooting. They have a lot of versatile pieces. Trae Young is clearly here in the playoffs. and has established himself that he is not afraid of anything, and his game is translating offensively really well. So, you know, off of that point with Trey, I want to ask you a question that I've been thinking about over the weekend.
Okay, so you're just on the golf course before pondering. Swings. Yeah, okay, yes, let's hear it.
Exactly. It's why I was slicing everything.
You know, in the lazy river, just on your float, being like, I got to ask Rohan this on Tuesday. Let's hear it.
Yeah, so Trey Young, obviously, this is his first postseason. Ja Morant, this is his first postseason, and he has played extremely well despite the Memphis Grizzlies being down 3-1 against the Utah Jazz. Like, who would you rather build a team around if you had to choose between these two? And I personally think it's like, I have an answer, but I think it's so, so close and so fascinating. I'm interested to hear what you think.
This is a great question because I think, like you said, it's incredibly hard. I love both guys a lot. They're both so fun to watch. And there's like, they both have like one like pretty glaring flaw that makes them both complicated and makes this such a decision you would waffle over. Oh God. I thought about this question when you told me you wanted me to choose between these two players. I was like, oh God, like, what am I going to do? And I was like, I'm just going to see what comes to my mind in the moment. And this is what's happening. I think though, I lean Ja Morant the tiniest bit, and which is crazy because I think Trey is like the modern offensive player, right? Like that's what you want. Mm-hmm. Someone who can shoot. Is passing, like, he can make all the passes now. The way he sprays the ball out to his shooters, I'm talking myself back into Trey again. This is what happens every time I pick one of them. And they both also have a great demeanor. Like you said, like, Trey is, like soaking this all in. He's been awesome during the playoffs. Ja is just, like, I don't know. There's something so, like, visceral and aggressive about the way he plays, and I think I just like players like that. And I think that's why I chose him. The fact that he's like tried to dunk on Gobert during every game, like, I think that's fun. I think that you could probably build a little bit better defense around him. I could see him becoming not a great shooter, but someone good enough that he's not going to get ignored the way he is oftentimes now. So you really cannot go wrong with either guy. I've gone back and forth no less than 100 times on which one I'd want. Like, they're both awesome, and I think they're both going to be great for many years.
There is no wrong answer here. By a hair, think that I would rather build around Trey. And, you know, I wrote recently, actually today, about the Memphis Grizzlies and their embrace of the floater. And that is one of Ja Morant's, you know, you talk about his explosiveness, you talk about him trying to just completely destroy Rudy Gobert at the rim on these dunk attempts. No, go ahead.
No, I know you're about to talk about his floater, but his patience, and it's like, it's, I hesitate to use this phrase, but his ability to navigate that area between the elbow and the restricted area is like, mm-hmm, Chris Paul-esque. He's not as good as Chris Paul, certainly, and he doesn't have the mid-range, but he just gets to that area and finds a pocket every night, and it's incredible.
The Chris Paul comparison is obviously you're ODing right now. Calm down. But the way he does the tight handle, the way he like can just manipulate his own body in midair when he takes off. Like, he's like, athletically, it's just no question, obviously. And I think that the floater has been really important to his game and really important to, you know, Memphis is down, but I think these games have been pretty competitive, more competitive. I mean,
Memphis
than
has had a chance to win all of them, I think. Maybe not the second one, but the last couple, I mean, yeah, it's been very close.
Yeah, within a possession with like 3 minutes to go. And the floater for him, for several other players on the team, is a reason why. But I'm not saying that Ja will never develop a lethal three-point shot. He hit five of them against the Golden State Warriors, obviously. But they were like, most of them were spot-ups. And the strategy that Golden State had was please shoot these, which is just, it's just different when, I know the results are nice, but it's just, it's a different thing and it impacts your offense differently than someone like Trey, who, you do not want Trey shooting threes, even though he only made 33% of the pull-ups that he attempted during the regular season. He's at 40% in the playoffs. And when he hits them, it just changes everything. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when he pulls up and he hits like a 33 footer, it's just, if I was a Knicks fan, it's your soul just disintegrates. It's a completely different feeling, and you're fighting over screens and you have to try to trap him on certain situations. You have to switch. You got to keep him away from that shot. You got to force him into the paint. And then he has his own floater, and he has, you know, I don't want to say that he's a better passer than Ja, because Ja is truly brilliant in the angles that he sees and the way he locates shooters, but I do think that Trey is a better passer than Ja. Trey is, I don't know how many passers alive are better than him, and the way he, when he gets under the rim and sort of does his Steve Nash impersonation and then just like finds Clint Capela 2 feet away, and somehow Clint Capella's man is so preoccupied with Trey that he just leaves him. It's amazing. It's magical. It's like he hypnotizes the defense over and over and over again. So I go with Trey by a hair, and I see both of their kind of defensive weaknesses as a push, which might not be fair to Ja, but for now, that's kind of how I feel about it.
It really comes down to, I think, do you trust, like, I'm putting a lot of faith in Ja, I think, having, you know, more physical tools than Trey to become better on the defensive end, especially after you were just talking about how, like, your strategy in a playoff round against the Hawks should be to attract Trey. You're right. I mean, like we've been saying, it's very close. One thing I'll just say about Ja, the fact that he's, you know, having the series he's having against, you know, Gobert and the Jazz, like a team that's been great defensively for several years in a row now. Like, there's all these advanced stats about just how great Gobert has been on the defensive end, how impactful he's been, which, you know, I'm not saying that he's not. Like, I believe in those stats. The way Morant has been able to manipulate that team at such a young age, against a team that's been through playoffs together, that has been so good for so long, is just been really, really impressive to me. That, you know, in the fourth quarter, I'm expecting him to get the shots that he wants. And it's, you just wouldn't expect that, I think, this early. And I've just been blown away by how much maturity he's shown in this series. Like, it really is remarkable.
So I want to hear, and Rohan does as well, what all of our listeners think about this question and all of our other takes that we spilled in this wonderful episode. But I think we've reached the end, Rohan, today. So I want to thank, again, all of our listeners for the wonderful emails. Please keep sending them to openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. I will be back on Thursday with Chris Herring. Rohan and I will be back next Monday, presumably to discuss Boston's incredible comeback to take down the Nets.
Can I just throw in one thing here real quick?
Sure.
I just want to thank all the Open Floor fans for, like, what a lovely reception. I'm sure Michael hid all the mean emails from me, but we know we got a nice email here or there. You got a nice tweet here or there. I just want to once again, with humility, just thank the Open Floor Globe for, you know, welcoming me in, you know, just at least giving me a shot here, you know, just giving me a chance. I appreciate it.
The Open Floor Globe is undefeated, and as I told Rohan over text, they are preserving my faith in humanity right now. So until our next episode, everyone, please stay safe and continue to enjoy watching NBA basketball.